Welcome. Inside Appalachia, I'm Jessica Lilly. In 2014, 300,000 people in and surrounding Charleston, West Virginia were left without water for days. This week on Inside Appalachia, we're looking back at stories reflecting on the Elk River chemical spill.
I was drinking it and it tasted gross and there was something different about it.
It was very frightening to turn on the water and that smell was, it gave me headaches. I had a physical reaction to it.
The smell was both sweet and sharp. I'm no dewy-eyed innocent about chemical leaks, but something about this confluence, the way I had to bring potable water to my family from 2 hours north, the strange look of the landscape wreathed in rain and mist, something about all of that made me absolutely buoyant in my rage.
You'll find these stories and more this week Inside Appalachia. Welcome. Inside Appalachia, I'm Jessica Lilly. On January 9th, 2014, a chemical spill contaminated the drinking water of more than 300,000 people in and around West Virginia's capital city. A state of emergency was declared, the National Guard was called in to assist with water distribution, and donations arrived from groups across the country. The leak brought up some serious questions about water, the most basic human need. So we wanted to bring you an encore presentation of the episode we made on the first anniversary of the Elk River spill. On this episode, we remember the challenges these Appalachians endured, check in to see if anything has changed since the spill, and we'll honor the traditional Appalachian way of coming together to lean on each other. We start with an award-winning story produced in 2014 by independent radio producer Anna Boyko-Wyrock. She talked with one family affected by the spill. Her work is called You Should Know What's Right Next Door. Here are the voices of the family Boyko-Wyrock talked with.
Looking back at everything, I determined that it was the 6th of January. I smelled something in my bathroom. It was a sickly, sweet smell. Although I'll tell you, I think it smells exactly like sugar-free Red Bull. That's what I associate it with now.
My name's Karen Ireland. I live in Charleston, West Virginia.
I think that I may have said something to the kids, like, do you smell that? Or while I was looking, kind of like, I wonder if the cat got sick. And I looked around and couldn't find anything. And I didn't smell it the next morning when I took a shower, but... And really lingered in the shower. Like, it was a really cold winter, and I hate to be cold, but I got out, got ready.
Excuse me.
I started to cough as I was getting ready, and I started feeling really badly in the car, like chilled, but also a little fevered. I went down the hill and maybe got to downtown and then was like, I'm not going. But I thought, I'm getting the flu because it was flu season. But I came home and I went straight to bed. And then the morning of the 9th, like at 7:30 or 8 in the morning, I saw a friend of mine post on Facebook, why does Edgewood smell like licorice?
State and federal authorities are working around the clock in Charleston, West Virginia.
We have one water intake. It's on the Elk River, and it's about a mile downstream from the site of the leak.
The spill comes from a 48,000-gallon chemical storage tank from Freedom Industries.
All 300,000 West Virginia American Water customers on this system get their drinking water from the Elk River and from the water intake, which is about a mile downstream from the Freedom Industries site that ended up being the source of the leak.
My friend is on Skype here, and we're playing Minecraft right now. That's him. Oh, shoot, I just punched you. Sorry, Cameron.
Can you come up here for a minute?
Dylan Ireland. I'm 13.
Could you come up here?
She pretty much just tells me not to, you know, and then I'll sneak behind her back and get tap water.
I'm Genevieve Ireland, and I am 11. So I used to like water and everything. I was drinking it, and it tasted gross, and there was something different about it.
So that's what we've been drinking. Spring water containers from Kroger that has a spout. I can remember putting socks over the taps in our bathroom because you go in, you know, when you're sleeping, if you get up in the middle of the night, it's easy to turn on the water and get a drink or brush your teeth or wash your hands. And it was easy to forget almost.
My name is Karen Ireland, and I stand before you tonight as a mother who is afraid to allow her children to take showers in their own home.
It made everything else I was doing seem inconsequential. I mean, aside from parenting.
And I'm a newly minted environmental activist.
Never too late.
But here I am. I'm tired. I'm reluctant, but I am mobilized.
You would think that drinking water is something that would be protected above all else because we all have to have it. But it's not the case. The water company should have wanted to know what was in their backyard. And why didn't they? They end up saying you can't test for all 85,000 chemicals that are not regulated or not tested. But certainly you could test for the ones that are right next door.
This is Inside Appalachia. That piece was produced by Anna Boyko-Wyrock. It won first place in what's known as the 24-hour radio race from KCRW's Independent Producer Project and first aired on the program called Unfictional. Today on our show, we're remembering the devastating effects that the Elk River chemical spill had for people in West Virginia. In January 2014, news about the chemical spill spread across the country. Folks reacted in many different ways. Some were furious, others felt helpless. Some were encouraged to send donations of water, and we'll hear about that later in the show. But first, we'll hear an essay that struck a chord with folks across the state and the country. A professor of literature and culture was surprised when his audacious essay in response to the chemical spill went viral. Eric Wagner's essay first appeared on his blog, and it was subsequently featured on CNN and The Huffington Post. Wagner is a professor at West Virginia Wesleyan who says he's surprised his words have traveled so far and wide. The best part, he says, is hearing from West Virginians who say, "That's how I feel." From the Inside Appalachia Archives, here's Eric Wagner with his essay, Elemental.
Elemental. On Saturday, January 11, 2014, I drove 2 hours south through the rain to Charleston, West Virginia, the city where I was born and where my parents, my sister, her husband, and my niece still live. In my car were 10 cases of bottled water, as my family hadn't been able to use tap water since Thursday. That's when a spill at the chemical company Freedom Industries dumped some 10,000 gallons of the hazardous material 4-methylcyclohexane methanol, MCHM, into the Elk River, a mile and a half upstream from the intake pipes for West Virginia American Water, affecting 9 counties that the company services. The spill was a result of leaks in a storage tank and in a concrete containment wall. Pollution prevention plans, we've all been told, that would have helped to address those concerns, apparently weren't filed with the state. About a mile and a half outside of the city, past small wood frame houses, gas stations, and grocery stores, I smelled it. The odor of the MCHM coming in through the car vents. The smell was both sweet and sharp. I'm no dewy-eyed innocent about chemical leaks. They were a regular occurrence when I was a kid. But something about this confluence, the way I had to bring potable water to my family from 2 hours north, the strange look of the landscape wreathed in rain and mist, the stench of a chemical that was housed directly upstream from the water company. Something about all of that made me absolutely buoyant in my rage. This was not the rational anger one encounters in response to a specific wrong, nor even the righteous anger that comes from an articulate reaction to years of systematic mistreatment. This was blind animal rage, and it filled my body to the limits of my skin. And this is what I thought. To hell with you. To hell with every greed-head operator who flocked here throughout history because you wanted what we had, but wanted us to go underground and get it for you. To hell with you for offering above-average wages in a place filled with people who'd never had a decent shot at employment or education, and then treating the people you found here like just another material resource, suitable for exploiting and using up, and then discarding when they'd outlived their usefulness. To hell with you all for exploiting the lax, poorly enforced safety regulations here so that you could do your business in the cheapest manner possible by shortcutting the health and quality of life not only of your workers, but also everybody who lives here. To hell with every operator who ever referred to West Virginians as our neighbors. To hell with every single screw job elected official and political who helped write those lax regulations and then turned away when even those weren't followed. To hell with you all who were supposed to be stewards of the public interest and who sold us out for money, for political power. To hell with every one of you who decided that making life convenient for business meant making life dangerous for us. To hell with you for making us the eggs you had to break in order to make breakfast. To hell with everyone who ever asked me how I could stand to live in a place like this, so dirty and unhealthy and uneducated. To hell with everyone who ever asked me why people don't just leave, don't just quit, like it never occurred to us, as if we dumb hilljacks would only listen as you explained the safety hazards, we'd all recognize something that hadn't been on our radar until now. To hell with the superior attitude one so often encounters in these conversations, and usually from people who have no idea about the complexity and the long history at work in it. To hell with the person I met who, within 10 seconds of finding out I was from West Virginia, congratulated me on being able to read. And as long as I'm roundhouse damning everyone, and since my own relatives worked in the coal mines and I can therefore play the family card, the one that trumps everything around here, to hell with all my fellow West Virginians who bought so deeply into the idea of avoidable personal risk and constant sacrifice as an honorable condition under which to live, that they turned that condition into a culture of perverted, twisted pride and self-righteousness, to be celebrated and defended against outsiders. To hell with that insular xenophobic pathology. To hell with everyone whose only takeaway from every story about every explosion, every leak, every mine collapse is some vague and idiotic vanity in the continued endurance of West Virginians under adverse, sometimes killing circumstances. To hell with everyone everywhere who ever mistook suffering for honor and whoever taught that to their kids. There's nothing honorable about suffering. Nothing. Like I said, it wasn't rational. I'm not an eco-warrior or a Luddite, and I'm not anti-business or even anti-industry. But there are sensible, sane ways to do things. That's what a society does to protect the people who live in it. Having been made to endure poison, air, earth, and water, we ought to make sure that history goes with us, always, into the voting booth, into the streets, into the home, into the wider world. Otherwise, to steal a line from the old hymn, will all of us, residents and politicians and operators alike, find ourselves standing in the fire next time.
That was Eric Wagner, professor at West Virginia Wesleyan College, with an essay that he wrote after the chemical spill last January. When we come back, we'll hear more responses from residents who remember what it was like to go without water during last year's water crisis.
I brush my teeth with Coca-Cola. I wash my face with Mountain Dew. We live down in Chemical Valley, the licorice water running through.
Licorice water running through.
I know politicians care about me. Lobbyists love me the same. Jesus, Lord, is watching over, but I don't trust that EPA. I don't trust that EPA.
Well, I brush my teeth with Coca-Cola, wash my face with Mountain Dew. We live down in Chemical Valley, licorice water running through. Licorice water running through.
CHM stands for methyl cyclohexane methanol. And now the catfish in Elk River drink the stuff that cleans our coal. They drink the stuff that cleans our coal.
Well, I brush my teeth with Coca-Cola. I wash my face with Mountain Dew. We live down in Chemical Valley, licorice water running through. Licorice water running through.
My bucket, pray for rain.
Put out the bucket and pray for rain. Well, I brush my teeth with Coca-Cola. I wash my face with Mountain Dew. We live down in Chemical Valley. Licorice water running through. Licorice water running through.
I know King Cole will keep my lights on. Union Carbide pays my bills. Still, it's better regulate than never. meet with Manchin on the hill, Senator Manchin on the hill. Well, I brush my teeth with the Coca-Cola, wash my face with Mountain Dew. We live down in Chemical Valley, licorice water running through, licorice water running through. Once we were almost heaven, now we're open for business. That's a place that I call home, West Virginia.
It was some 10 days before all the families affected by the tap water ban following Charleston's chemical spill were able to return to life as usual within their homes. And many did just that, once again drinking, cooking, and bathing with water straight from the tap. The same, however, can't be said for every family in the Valley, including Lida Shepherd. Liz McCormick with West Virginia Public Broadcasting met up with Shepherd, who wouldn't drink the water 1 year after the spill.
I want somebody to drink.
Okay, do you want some water?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Let me get you some water. We have a teeny, teeny, tiny bit left.
That's Lida Shepherd and her 2-year-old daughter, Lucia. They live in a small apartment on the east end of Charleston. Lucia loves tea.
You know where they live in
Sissonville.
You want some tea?
Mm-hmm.
It is delicious. Yeah, are we going to have tea in the tea set?
This time last year, tea wasn't so easy to make. Lida and her daughter were one of many families directly affected by the January 9th chemical leak.
When I first got the word of the chemical leak and the chemical spill, it was very frightening. It was very frightening to turn on the water, and that smell was, I mean, it gave me headaches. I mean, I had definitely a physical reaction to it.
Her reaction was similar to hundreds of Kanawha Valley residents' reports to their doctors.
I've been using these jugs for months now. They're getting a little tired, but
Lida and her daughter now use city water to bathe and wash dishes and laundry in, but they still refuse to drink from the tap. Instead, Lida drives 20 miles to her parents' farm in Sissonville to collect 4 to 6 gallons of water each week from their well. It's a practice she began a year ago when the water use ban was still in place.
It certainly has had lasting effects on me. It's now, even when I travel anywhere, I would just drink water from the tap where I go. That's not the case anymore. I always just sort of think about where I am and like, well, what's going on with the water here? There's definitely some sort of lasting fears, and like I said, I still don't drink the water.
Lida is an advocate for WV Free, an organization that focuses on rights for women. And she also works with the American Friends Service Committee, where she directs a youth leadership program in Boone County, an area also affected by the spill.
They grow up in communities where not being able to drink the water comes up a lot. This was not a new experience for them to get word that the water wasn't safe. And so when the chemical spill happened, some of them very much reacted, just like, I'm not dead yet. Literally, that's one of the girls said. She's like, oh, I'm showering in it.
Lida says some of her students, however, felt angry at their lawmakers, blaming them for letting this happen, or in some cases, continue to happen. After the spill and hearing from her students, Lida says it empowered her to want to make a difference in her state. She's often advocated for stricter regulations and held a fundraiser at the time to provide bottled water to those who needed it.
Reflecting on a year after the chemical spill, what we've been able to achieve and organize around, I'm pretty impressed by. I think because Charleston, you know, sort of a population center, was largely impacted, it shed light on an issue that was an issue before this chemical spill.
You can make some tea in a teapot.
We're going to eat our soup first and then we'll have some tea.
As for Lucia, Lida says her daughter will continue to have tea parties with drinks made from her parents' well water, at least for now. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Liz McCormick in Charleston. Thank you.
Hear that? Eh? That means it's time for What's in a Name. This week, we're going to a town in southern West Virginia that's also nicknamed the Dogwood City and is often called Home of Champions in basketball after claiming several state high school titles before consolidation in 1998. Here's a hint. I was once on the sidelines in uniform cheering on the team. We'll have the answer after the break. You're listening to Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly with the answer to this week's What's in a Name quest. So what town is known as the Dogwood City and often referred to as Home of Champions in high school basketball? Mullins, West Virginia. This one has an interesting story behind it, and to help us out this week is Wyoming County Circuit Clerk David Bugs Stover. Yet again, there are two stories behind the town of Mullins.
Mr. Mullins wanted to own a farm where Mullins is now. And he spelled his name M-U-L-L-I-N-S. The story is, it's even on that sign up there, that he apparently forgot to dot his I. And he looped his I, like a lot of people do, and left it off, and people for then after assumed that was an E and named it Mullins, M-U-L-L-E-N-S. Now, I happen to have found the records here, being the circuit clerk, of when that group of people living up there got together and decided to incorporate their town. On the very same documents, he often spelled his name with what looked like an E and what looked like an I, which probably explains what happened. One of those inadvertent things.
Stover points out that most towns in the region, like much of Appalachia, were named by the postmaster. It was important to have a unique name so the mail didn't get mixed up.
There is the story that down at what is now New Richmond, when they sent off to find out if they could name it Mullins, there was a postmaster there named Mullins, M-U-L-L-E-N-S, and they thought how clever and sneaky a way to get the town named after M-U-L-L-E-N-S, them, instead of M-U-L-L-I-N-S, the guy who actually owned the farm that made the town. My guess, that probably didn't happen. My guess, since I saw the documents, and there he spelled it differently himself.
Want to suggest a town name that we explore on Inside Appalachia? Send us a tweet at InAppalachia, hashtag What's in a Name. This is Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. 2 years since the chemical spill in West Virginia, there have been some updates. A recent report says that privately owned West Virginia American Water in Charleston has not taken adequate measures to protect against potential disasters. The report says the company hasn't investigated enough to existing infrastructure, among other complaints. The report comes from Boston Action Research, a project of the Civil Society Institute. And what about Freedom Industries, the company responsible for the leaked MCHM chemical that contaminated drinking water in the Elk River? Well, two former Freedom executives have agreed to a settlement in a class action lawsuit. Under the proposed settlement, former Freedom president Gary Southern would pay $350,000 and former executive Dennis Farrell would pay $50,000 to residents and businesses affected by the spill. Also, Southern and Farrell are awaiting sentencing on federal pollution charges. They are among several defendants named in the lawsuit. And Freedom Industries filed for bankruptcy following the spill. A federal bankruptcy judge recently approved a liquidation.
Thank you.
But the chemical spill also brought out something that folks can take pride in, pulling together and helping out. Yes, water and supply donations came from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, organizations, and folks across the country. But some of those donations came from the water drives in West Virginia. Neighbor helping neighbor. Some of them came from folks like Charlene Cook from Mullins, a town that struggled with its own water issues in the past. I spoke with her shortly after the spill.
You know, go without water for a few days and you'll see just how much you miss that water.
Charlene Cook is the director of operations at the Mullins Opportunity Center. Cook says these items are meant to help those who remain without access to clean water, one of whom she ran into while at a restaurant in Beckley.
She was just a smiling, saying, "Hey, I'm one of those people you're talking about, you know." And she was there in Raleigh County to buy water, because she said she stood in line for 8 hours for a gallon of water, and my heart just broke for her. I thought, oh, my word, 8 hours. I can't imagine that she drove from Dunbar to get her water. So, you know, there's so many out there that can't drive from Dunbar to get their water.
Cook says donations are also meant to help those carrying a financial burden during this time.
People, it's hard-pressed right now because people are out of work also.
Cook remembers all too well what it's like to be without water. Mullins has been rebuilding since a massive flood in 2001.
We've been in the boil water advisories. We've lost everything in the Mullins area, so we know what it is to have a need. So, you know, it would be good if we as a community that we could reach out.
While the state of emergency was lifted in Charleston, folks in the coal fields still struggle with the challenge to get clean water every day. Some communities have been on a boil water advisory for years, and it doesn't look like it's going to be lifted anytime soon. That story first aired right after the chemical spill in January 2014. While the state of emergency was lifted in Charleston, folks in the coal fields still struggle with the challenge to get clean water every day. Some communities have been on a boil water advisory for years, and it doesn't look like it's going to be lifted anytime soon. While southern West Virginia has an abundance of water, the crumbling infrastructure and extreme terrain creates challenging situations. So although the nightmare for those folks in West Virginia's capital city might be over, going without water is a way of life for some people in the coal fields. Many of the current water systems in place were installed in the early 1900s by coal companies, while other places simply don't have water in their homes at all. For some communities, a boil water advisory is a way of life, like in Keystone in McDowell County, where residents have been on an advisory since 2010. Neighboring North Fork is often called the Sister City and has been on a boil water advisory since 2013. The water systems are currently operated by the cities, but the McDowell County Public Service District is in the process of taking on the responsibilities. It's a basic human need. There's food, clothing, shelter, and water. How long could you go without clean water in your home? Governor Tomlin issued a state of emergency in 9 West Virginia counties for almost 7 weeks. The declaration dispatched the National Guard to assist and deliver clean water for the affected residents. But for the town of North Fork, a boil water advisory since July of 2013 didn't get any attention and has not merited a state of emergency.
We usually have to do bottled water because we don't drink it at all. Even on good days, we don't ever drink the water here.
Nicole Bright lives in North Fork with her husband and 2 children. Including the active advisory, the town of about 180 customers has been on 7 boil water advisories since 2009, some lasting for months. It's been an ongoing issue for years.
That's not how it's supposed to be. This is like third world country or something.
Bright welcomes me into her home and explains that the white plastic buckets stacked at the door are for holding water. The family has to be prepared for the next time they go without water.
Mine is too small, so she bathed a lot in the sea. But here's some more water jugs. But as far as us, we had to go to like my grandma's, or, and here it is. And also,
Bright taps on another stack of plastic containers piled in the hallway just outside the bathroom. This stack is to flush the toilets. You see, here, the biggest challenge is having water at all.
I mean, the water, it goes off pretty often. It stays off for about, last time was 27 days. And it's real hard to do with the kids going to school and cleaning and washing clothes and cooking and dishes. It's just really hard. But usually, before it goes off or anything, it'll be real dirty looking and then it'll be orange.
For Bright and other residents in North Fork, losing water is so common that her family now has a routine when she does laundry, brushes her teeth, and other everyday tasks. To do the dishes, she first goes to the front porch, and then...
get the water, then you come in, you take 5-gallon buckets and pour it into a little bitty pot, and then we heat it up, which usually takes about, 45 minutes or something to do, to fill them up and get enough water in there to wash and rinse.
Added expenses include bottled water, paper plates, and travel. Still, she tries not to complain.
3 or 4 days, yes. When it's out for a while, we do call, especially when you're able to get off the hill and not see anyone working on it. Now, my neighbor, she'll call them every 5 minutes. That's why I try not to give them such a hard time, because Lord knows I know she does. So I try to be nice, and then I'll call the neighbors.
The water system operated by the town of North Fork is outdated, and the filter needs to be replaced. So employees have to flush the system about every other day, causing the pressure to drop, especially for customers like Bright, who live at higher elevations.
It seems like sometimes when you live in a place like this, you're not heard, as well as you would be if you were somewhere else in a different town or something like that. Here it's like, okay, you're in North Fork, so what, you're in McDowell County. What do you expect? That kind of attitude.
But some folks in McDowell can remember a different attitude for the region. A little further up Route 52, we find Betty Younger. A coal miner's daughter, Betty Younger grew up in McDowell County and remembers a very different community during the 1950s. Younger sits on her front porch, which sits close to Route 52, a road busy with coal trucks. She reminisces about her days in the Kyle coal camp.
It was just a fun time for school and all. We all rode the school buses together, and it was just a big community of happiness. Everybody, every neighbor looked out for each other, and it was such a difference then than it is now.
Like so many coal-dependent communities, McDowell has suffered the boom and bust of the industry and a sharp population decline. In the 1950s, there were more than 100,000 people. Today, less than 20,000 remain in the county.
This part of McDowell County is looked upon like, there's nothing here. No one wants to come back here to stay. They come back to visit, but no one wants to come here and back to really to live in certain sections of McDowell County. We just don't have like we once had.
Younger has lived in this home in Elkhorn for about 6 years. There have been so many issues with the water, she just assumes not to drink it and says she rarely uses it for cooking. But the quality of the water is the least of her worries.
We never know when we're not going to have water.
And that's the story for several communities in the region. While winter months can be particularly hard because of freezing pipes, water outages could happen in places like Elkhorn, Keystone, or North Fork any time of the year.
You need water to get up to get ready for work in the morning. To drink water, you have to go out and buy water out of your pocket now, because the water system is not flowing like it should.
This past summer, a project that residents have been hearing about for years finally broke ground. Phase one of what's being called the Elkhorn Water Project. When all three phases are complete, the project will replace the system that Younger and other residents currently rely on. Phase one will replace a leaky, rusty tank that is believed to date back to the 1940s, set up by coal companies of that day. Younger's house sits just beyond the phase one project. But like so many folks in the region, she's thankful for what she does have. To younger and other folks, it's a way of life.
I try not to complain, and then I just, you know, just ask the Lord to bless us and keep us, that we have water when we need water. So
our ambition and our goal is to provide as much clean water as we can for every citizen of McDowell County.
That's Eldon Green, Assistant Director of McDowell County Public Service District, after the groundbreaking ceremony last year.
We are very grateful for how that through the slow-moving bureaucratic process of the government, we're finally seeing this good thing happen in our county today.
Green is proud to say the district started out with 500 customers in 1990 and has more than 3,000 customers today.
There's a crumbling, decaying, almost non-existent water system in the area, and not even all of our customers or households have that public water. Some have springs and wells. But as with any rural community where the major industry has come and gone, we face negative things. We face low incomes. We face dilapidated housing. And it's just been a terrible, terrible struggle.
Phase one will bring water to Elkhorn, Mayberry, and Switchback. The McDowell County PSD is working to find funding for several other projects like this one throughout the county. The Big Sandy Rotifield extension will bring clean water to Green's own home. He currently has a deep well.
I have a water treatment system personally that is salt-based, and they say over the long term that's not good. But we're thankful for what we have.
The first phase of the project was funded by grants and loans from the United States Department of Agriculture, Rural Development. The dated systems in this part of southern West Virginia took an even bigger blow in 2001 and 2002, when what was called the 100-year flood hit 2 years in a row. The massive floods impacted everything, including water systems, and had a devastating impact on the communities.
So hard to put back what you took away before, just to have you come and take it all again. 10,000 people cried, 7 people died, and I could hear the devil laughing in the wind.
Muddy water, can you hear me? Can't you see what you have done? Can't you see that you're not welcome here today? We worked hard all our lifetimes for what little bit we had, just to have you come and take it all away.
Those floods only magnified the water challenges in that region, but the problem stretches further than McDowell. Looking at a map that says Region 1 Planning and Development Council Water and Sewer, GIS specialist Eric Combs paints a picture of the need for potable water in McDowell, Wyoming, Monroe, Summers, and Mercer counties.
There is a great need throughout the whole state, but it seems like there's a greater need, per se, in southern West Virginia.
Combs points to 58 water and sewer projects expected in the near to distant future for this area. One reoccurring challenge is replacing dated systems left behind by coal companies.
Community of Gary in McDowell County, that was put in by American Mine and Steel, so U.S. Steel rather. You're looking at 50s, 60s, and it hasn't been updated since.
That's one dated system that Jennifer Haas is familiar with. Haas, now the project manager for the West Virginia Water Research Institute, grew up in Gary and says during the 60s, 70s, and early 80s, her father maintained the Gary water system as an employee of U.S. Steel. Around that time, the company began to pull out and close mines in the area.
When they left, they turned it over to the city, and my dad ended up taking over operation, being the operator for them, for their water system and also the wastewater system. They eventually brought other folks on board for the wastewater side, so he stayed with the drinking water side until just a few years ago.
And that's a common story throughout the coal fields of West Virginia. But some communities didn't necessarily keep water operators. In neighboring Wyoming, County Clerk Mike Goode explains.
Back in the 30s and 40s when coal was booming, coal companies made these coal camps, and they put in water systems for them. As the coal companies moved out, they abandoned those utilities, and the citizens had to take them over. Those things, like everything else, they were worn out, and it just came to the fact that somebody had to do something.
Goode and other elected officials made it a priority to replace the coal camp water systems and is proud to share success stories about places like Copperston, Wyoming, and Glover, where it was the folks in the communities making the repairs and doing what had to be done to get water in their homes.
Glover, those people get out in the middle of the night, older people, you know, 70 and 80 years old, they're out digging up water lines trying to fix a leak. It ain't supposed to be that way in America.
Despite the struggle to maintain these dated, crumbling systems, throughout the region, it seems the communities left with coal company plumbing were the fortunate ones. Some places don't have systems at all, but they make do with what they have. Jennifer Halls paints the picture she saw at Coal Mountain.
Their source of water was a reused gasoline tank that set up on the hillside that collected water from spring, and then a series of garden hoses brought it down the hill basically to another storage tank that someone would go and add a few gallons of bleach to ever so often to disinfect it. But that was the water that was then distributed to the homes for people to use.
For those who might just be tuning in, we're not describing some undeveloped, impoverished country, but a community in the United States of America, not too far from the nation's capital. Haas says the Coal Mountain water system is pretty typical for the coalfield region. Not necessarily a gas tank, but...
You know, there's communities all over the country. Unfortunately, Appalachia is very heavily populated with these small communities that they may have a spring with a water hose coming down to the homes, or they go and collect in water jugs, or they'll go to the river and collect in water jugs. They use that water for toilet flushing, for rinsing or washing clothes, but as far as for cooking and drinking, they probably buy bottled water.
And residents are resourceful, resilient with these circumstances. For some folks, it's the abandoned coal mines that are often used for a source of drinking water, too, like this one in Itmann in Wyoming County, where a pipe comes out of the side of the mountain on the side of the road. Folks often stop to fill up. County Circuit Clerk David Bug Stover grew up just a few miles from here in Pierpoint.
And they ran it from an old coal mine on one side of the mountain, under the railroad track, and across the creek, and then dug ditches and ran it to the house in Pierpoint. The system there, in fact, is much the same now. It's from a different coal mine, and the town actually owns the site of where the exit of that mine, and a little tiny site where they build a big tank. And all that water, gravity feeds down to where the houses are. And it sometimes is treated and sometimes not. But it's water that comes there from a coal mine, and that's how they get water where I'm from.
Stover says it was truly a community system with its own set of challenges.
You go out and try to fix it. If you can't find the leak, sometimes my mom, one time I remember, didn't have water for 3 months. It can almost drive you to the edge of being insane for months. So as much as I felt, and I did feel, for the people in Charleston who were without water for a week, whatever, I know what it's like to go for months. And if you want water, you go somewhere and carry it out of the creek or out of a coal mine. That happens. It happens today. And it will continue to happen for a while.
So while pickup trucks hauling water was an unusual and perhaps unsettling sight in Charleston last year during the chemical spill, it's common and part of everyday life for folks in the coal fields.
They make haul around a great big tank in the back of a truck. What those people tend to do is drive to a place where water's coming out of the mountain, out of an old coal mine, and they'll simply back their truck up and either directly under the flow or run a pipe from it and fill that up. And then they'll have, 300 or 400 gallons of water in the back of their truck. And they'll come up to their house and hook it in and run water till it's gone and go do the same thing. Still going on today.
I should also point out that while doing this report, I found folks proud of their independence and accepting of what they called the sacrifice of mountain living. After all, it's more expensive to install a system to reach residents on a mountain than it would be for a flat city. Others were impatient with what they called empty promises of access to public water. Still, for the self-proclaimed mountain men, they wouldn't have it any other way. Again, Wyoming County Clerk Mike Goode.
But you have people that are third or fourth generation that they've had to carry their water or use a well that's got a lot of iron in it or have a spring, and they don't know that there's a better life than that. And, I mean, it's healthy. It's better. It's healthier for you to have good city water. You know, it's treated and, you know, chlorine, it's sanitized and all that. I mean, it's got to be healthier.
But mountain springs and abandoned mines can be a good source of water. Some of the best water in the world, in fact. Sometimes. Mark Glass with Downstream Strategy says folks still should just be cautious.
What you worry about there, I think, too, is the same thing you worry about if you're doing a surface water. You know, your groundwater needs to be protected in the same way. So what are the potential contamination conduits to that? You know, if you're in areas of mining, certainly there's lots of shafts and, you know, we hear all the talk about, you know, abandoned gas wells being potential conduits if there's surface spills and things like that. So they would still need to be under these same source water protection assessments. And then assessing all those potential conduits, the ways that this could become polluted in different scenarios, and then what you do about it.
For many folks in the coal fields today, crumbling, sometimes abandoned coal industry water systems, mountain springs, streams, and store-bought bottled water. These are the options. And they can't live without water. Times of tragedy often bring out that spirit of resilience that is such a strong part of Appalachian communities. That community spirit during coal mining accidents is what inspired West Virginia native Bill Withers to write this song.
Sometimes in our lives, we all have pain, we all have sorrow, but if we are wise, we know that there's always tomorrow. Lean on me when you're not strong.
I mean, who doesn't love that song, right? It tickled my fancy to find out that Withers grew up in Slab Fork, a coal camp town in Raleigh County about 30 minutes from my hometown. Withers was recently selected for the induction into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and back in 2007, he was inducted into the West Virginia Music Hall of Fame. Anna Sale, now host of WNYC's Death, Sex, and Money podcast, spoke with Withers back in 2007, just before the ceremony.
My family lived right beside this railroad track. And so all the white people lived on one side of the railroad track and all the black people lived on the other side of the railroad track. Well, my mother bought a house that was just on the side that she wasn't supposed to buy it on. But it was, you know, just two houses, two families, you know, that were allowed over there. But when I was growing up, wherever I heard noise, that's where I went to play. So, and everybody called me little brother. In fact, my mother was looking for me on the side where all the white people live once, and she was calling me by my name, and nobody said, no, we haven't seen him. Then she thought, well, maybe they called him. So they said, have you seen little brother? I said, oh, yeah, he's right over there. So there was always a certain interaction here, I think more so than most southern states.
Do you think, I mean, how much of that, in terms of like a coal community and a coal camp kind of community where everybody's doing the same kind of work and Do you think that played into that?
Well, if you can stand the humor in it, you know, when you come out of the coal mines, everybody's black. You know what I mean? Plus, you're in a very dangerous situation. And people have to have a certain trust for each other, you know what I mean? And then people become necessary to each other. So that environment, you know, will make you kind of get to understand the guy, you know, working over here because you want him to be reliable. You know what I mean?
Is it true that the song Lean On Me was written thinking about those types of relationships?
Well, you know, I think we all become the composite of the places we've been and the people we've met. And I think wherever you grow up, you know, you can go somewhere else, but you never really leave that place. You know, it goes with you, the good and the bad, you know. And so probably growing up in a place where that thing I was telling you about people kind of needing each other. I remember we had a phone and the people across the street had a refrigerator, so they gave us ice and they used our phone. You know what I mean? So there was a certain, you know, just the economics made people kind of share and help each other out.
If there is a load
That's our show. Thanks for joining me as we journey throughout Appalachia. Music in today's show was provided by Bill Withers, Andy Agnew Jr., Tim O'Brien, and Kathy Matea with Brush My Teeth, Jake Sheps and the Glenville State Bluegrass Band. Our producer is Roxy Todd. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. Find us on Twitter @InAppalachia or @JessicaYLilly. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and at wvpublic.org. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.